Chapter 40, and I've given it the title, as I mentioned already, When God Went Camping. When God Went Camping. So we introduced it a little bit there with the children of what it was for the Israelites. And maybe in that time they'd been living in their tents around Mount Sinai up until this point. There they have been, I say, for 9 months in the end. Of course, it takes some months to build the tabernacle and things like that. So they've heard from God, and God met them there at Mount Sinai. God came down on the mountain with an earthquake and fire and cloud and trumpet and smoke and a loud voice. And he gave them the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. He gives them some more laws in the chapters that follow, 21 to 23. And then in chapter 24, we looked at it last time, 2 weeks ago, how Moses and the elders come and meet with God. We said there's some links then to what's going to happen with the tabernacle as well. Probably at the same time come all the other instructions that are given in the other books, like Leviticus and so on, as well, that are referred to elsewhere. And then maybe the Israelites are beginning to think, though, what next? Here they are, literally, in the middle of nowhere, in this area in Arabia, and they've met with God on the mountain. But God has told them that they're going to go onto a promised land, that he's going to show them. And maybe the Israelites were wondering to themselves, well, is God going to come with us? He said he'd send his angel ahead. We read a bit of that last time, end of chapter 23. He said he's going to send his angel ahead of them into the promised land, things like that. But is God going to be with them? What about in a week's time, after they leave Mount Sinai? For some who've done their Duke of Edinburgh, you know, you take up all your backpack, you know, put everything in your backpack and you head on. And then the next day you take out your tent and put it up again. And then, you know, if you're doing one of the other Duke of Edinburgh, you go on further than each day. And that's what life was like for the Israelites. As they set out from Mount Sinai, in the end they would journey for a whole day. Then they set up camp again. Then the next day they'd head on again. And that is what they would do. But what happens in a week's time? Would God still be with them? Or would you sort of look back at the distance and see Mount Sinai still on the horizon and go, that's where we met God. But he's over there now. And we're on our own. What happens when they're on the border of the promised land? And what happens when they're in the promised land and they've got to go into battle and things like that? Is God going to be with them? Maybe they were beginning to wonder what would happen next. And so while Moses goes up the mountain to talk to God, God gives instructions for how he's going to come with them in the journey. How he is going to go with them on this epic camping trip. And he's going to live in a tent too. And what a gracious thing that is. What a humble thing. It kind of seems fitting that God would meet them on the top of a mountain and all the things that go on there with this great big noise and the cloud and things like that, and they've got to be right at the very bottom, hundreds of feet below him. Now that kind of makes sense, doesn't it, of how inapproachable God is. And God says, I'm going to come and live in the tent with you, on your campsite. And what a shocking thing that is to think about. Maybe especially if you don't like camping and you can't imagine the squalor of living in a tent and you'd quite like to be in a hotel or whatever it might be. Maybe that makes sense. But God's going to come and live in a tent. What a humble thing that is. What a precious thing that is. And he tells them that that's what it's all about in chapter 25 and verse 8. He says, "There, let the Israelites make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them." That's the promise. I'm going to live with them. And so, look on in chapter 25 and verse 22. He gives instructions there for the building of the ark, which we'll get to eventually. And he says in verse 22, "And there I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from there above the ark." That's at the centre of it, which we'll get to in the end. He said, "I'm going to meet with you there. I'm going to speak to you there in this tent." And so it becomes known as the tent of meeting. While they were building the tabernacle, Moses used a tent temporarily, and that sometimes is called the tent of meeting as well, where people could meet with God, just an ordinary tent. That seems in the process of while they were building the proper one. And then in the end, this proper one becomes known as the tent of meeting as well, because God promised, there I'm going to meet with you inside it. And that's what it's all about. Head on to chapter 40. We're sort of top and tailing it a little bit this time. And there you have that description. On the first day of the first month, you shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. It's the tent where we meet. It's the place where we meet God. That's what he's saying to his Israelites, to the Israelite people. And what an amazing thing that is. And the tent then itself has something of great magnificence, and at the same time, one that is very ordinary. In chapter 26, just read a little bit of it, chapter verse 1. Moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine woven linen, blue and purple and scarlet thread, with artistic designs of cherubim woven on it. And the width of the curtain shall be this, that, and the other, and so on. Head on to verse 7 for now. And you shall make curtains of goat's hair to be a tent over the tabernacle. You shall make 11 of these curtains. And then verse 14, you shall make a covering of ram skins dyed red with a tent, and a covering of badger skins above that. And you shall make boards of acacia wood, verse 15, standing upright. And on the one hand, it's a little bit tricky to get your head around exactly how all these things are going to be constructed. It's both magnificent, in one sense, with all its purple and red and blue. It's going to look very royal, isn't it, with those kind of colours. Loads of golden stuff is going to be there attached to it. Loads of things are going to be there in the tent. So it is going to look impressive on one level. But on the other side, it is also quite ordinary. It is covered with goat's skins. And that's what all their tents were covered with too. All of their tents were covered with goat skins. That's what everyone made tents out of in those days. And God's tent is going to be both magnificent and ordinary. Magnificent on the inside, really. Quite ordinary looking from the outside. And maybe that will come in later on. And that's what God's going to do. He's going to live with them. But there, just before we get too much further than that, what a wonderful application of the God who comes close. A God who is not distant and far away, but wants to draw near to his people so I can meet with you, he says. And that's the God we worship. Not some faraway God, as some other religions have, and so on. Just this forced impression of God being so distant and unconcerned. No, he's the God who draws near. Second thing we see, a tent that was central. If you head on to the book of Numbers, lots more details are given there as well. But in Numbers chapter 2, it's described what we just did a little bit with the children of what the Israelite camp is going to be like. And in Numbers chapter 2, we're told on the east side, that's this side over here, you're going to have the tribes of Judah camping, and then Issachar and Zebulun. They're going to camp on the east side. And then on the south side of the camp, that's the bottom edge, on this one here, you've got Reuben and Simeon and Gad. That's where those tribes are going to camp. Then if you're working it through in Numbers chapter 2, then you're told, and then the Levites, they're going to camp in the middle. More of them in a moment. Heading on with the other tribes, on the far side, the western side, you've got Ephraim, Manasseh and Benjamin. And then on the northern edge, this one nearest me, you've got the tribes of Dan and Asher and Naphtali. And it's all arranged like a big grid. There's all these tribes mapped out round it, 3x3 on every side. Then on the inner ring, you've got the Levites, whose job it was going to be to serve in the temple. That included the priests and things like that as well. So it made sense for them to be living nearest to it, because they're going to work in the tabernacle and things like that. And that's where they're all going to live. But God's going to be there right in the very centre. The other thing that comes across in the Numbers passage and in some of those descriptions, maybe why sometimes it sounds so complicated in some of those chapters of instructions, is because the whole thing is movable. The whole thing is dismantleable. So it's all these kind of wooden frames that are going to hold up bits of the tent, and how everything's going to have sort of hinges and pegs and things like that's going to make it all then dismantle into smaller bits. So they can then carry it. Some of the big bits in the temple are going to have rings through the sides of it so they can put in carrying poles and things like that. The whole point is that this is going to move again so that God is going to go with them as it all being represented in those things. And in Numbers chapter 2, it's going to be the same order when on the move. So when the time comes to pack up camp and head on, they're going to march out in exactly that same format, with Judah and Issachar and Zebulun leading the way. Then you've got Reuben, Simeon and Gad coming next. Then the Levites carrying all the tabernacle in the middle of the column, if you like. Then bringing up the rear, you've got Ephraim, Manasseh and Benjamin, and then Dan, Asher and Naphtali at the back. And so they're going to march in one ginormous column of people, and God's going to be in the middle. And all the tabernacle gear is going to be packed down and carried by the Levites, and they're going to carry the ark and things like that, showing that God is there with them on the move. And it had to be like that. That was the place where God belonged, wasn't it? And so there's something for us to think about, even in our New Testament era. God has to be central. That's where he belongs. You cannot worship the true and living God and have him just on the fringe of your life, because that isn't worshipping him. A real relationship with God has him at the centre of our lives. You can't just have a little God fad that you just pick up every now and again. Then it's not a relationship with him, because he belongs at the centre. He has to be. There's nowhere else he can be because of who he is. We haven't got time today, but maybe you could read through over the next couple of weeks the chapters in between. And maybe just thinking about some of these big things will help make a little bit of head and tail of it. Don't get lost in all the details of goat skins and ram skins and dye this and dye that and wooden frames and all kinds of things. Well, that is a pretty complicated stuff. But stick with the main sort of things that we're thinking of this morning, and maybe that will shed a bit of light on it. But there are these chapters of instructions. 25 begins with instructions on how they're going to build the ark and the table and the lampstand. Then in chapters 26, how they're going to build the tent itself, the tabernacle. Chapter 27, how they're going to build the altar of sacrifice, how they're going to make the courtyard, the screens that go around it, things like that, how they're going to make the oil that needed for the lamps. On to chapter 28, and they describe the clothes for the priests. Chapter 29 is a little bit different, because then they start consecrating the priests. But back on then in chapter 30 with more instructions, how they're going to build the altar of incense, how they're going to build the basins or lavers, things like that they're called. And then chapter 31, who they're going to appoint to be craftsmen. And so you've got this big set of instructions through the chapters up to that point. And then carrying on then from 35, you've got a chapter about how they then start doing it. You've got instructions and constructions. How they get together all the materials, as was referenced in 25, the kind of things they then supply. Then in chapter 36, the craftsmen start work. In chapter 37, they build the ark, the table, the lampstand and the incense altar. In chapter 38, they build the altar of sacrifice, the basin and the courtyard. In chapter 39, they build the clothes for the priests. And in chapter 40, they complete it. So you kind of see it works through twice. Once we're told them what they should do, and then we're told what they do. If that makes sense. And so it maps the whole things out, and you can sort of follow them in some ways a bit like that. There's one interruption, that's those chapters in the middle, 31 to 34, which is the golden calf and its aftermath. In some sense, it doesn't belong there in the middle, and maybe it shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have been there in the middle in that sense. It should have been just God giving the instructions and them doing it, shouldn't it? But we'll come back to that another time. But one thing in that, as so you can perhaps look through those and read some of those things for yourself, the one thing that comes across is that this is precise. We might not be able to get our heads round all of that. That's okay. It also says that God shows Moses what to do. So whether there's more things going on as well that makes it a bit difficult for us perhaps at a distance. But you've got these six chapters of instructions. And it's summarised in that bit we read today, chapter 40, verse 16. And they obey each part. That's why we're told it twice in one way. We've got the instructions, then we've got the constructions. And so in chapter 40, verse 16, Thus Moses did, according to all that the Lord commanded him, so he did. And that's it, it's precise. And so it is gracious that God comes to live with them. It's wonderful that God's going to live there in a tent. But they mustn't forget he's holy. They mustn't forget that it has to be done exactly as he said. There's going to be a tent wall around the site. Just two things we might pick up this morning. There's going to be this rectangular wall. I think a little bit like the side walls of a marquee. A little bit like that sort of strung on post, I think. And that's going to go round the whole site of where the tabernacle is going to be. And then in one side, over on this side, on the east side, you've got one entrance. One entrance is over here. You can come and have a look at it later on. And they're going to go in through this site, on the east side. And as they come towards where God lives, what are they going to meet? They're going to come through in through the one entrance. They're going to come past the altar of sacrifice. They're going to come past the basin for washing. And then they're going to be standing in front of the tent where God lives. And even in that precision with which God describes those things, there it is set out for us. We'll come back to that in a minute. God gives us instructions on how we come to him. So it's wonderful that God comes close. And we said there's some false religions who say, oh, God's very distant and he doesn't care. That's not true. But then some false religions go the opposite way and say, oh, well, look, well, God's all around us. And, oh, we can just do what we like. Oh, you want to go and hug a tree and feel the presence of God in a tree? Well, just don't do that. And they make up all kinds of rubbish then the other way. But the truth is that God does draw near, and he then says how this is going to work, how we're going to approach him, how we can know the living God who does come close. So we're going to think of those three things. We thought of the tent that was gracious, a tent that was central, and a tent that was precise. We'll come back to those three headings in just a moment. But we're going to think, well, of a tent that shows us Christ. And in all of those things, God does this in the Old Testament. It was a temporary thing. Tents are always temporary. And not to be permanent. God did this at this time for the people of Israel. But all of those things were recorded for us in the Bible so that it might show us Christ. And this tent is there to do that, to show us Christ. So let's think of those three things again. Firstly, that he's gracious. And if you want to head to the book of John, strangely, John seems a big fan of camping, because he picks up this idea of tabernacling several times. The first one's the very well-known one in John chapter 1, verse 14. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. And so much of that, as I say, comes from that bit of Exodus. The Word became flesh and dwelt, or tabernacled, or camped among us. And what a gracious thing that is. Even more so. Even more than God living in a tent is when God comes as a human being. Those words which God said in Exodus, by this construction, I'm going to dwell with you. And that is what God says. That is what Christ says when he comes into the world in the incarnation, isn't it? A human body you have prepared for me, that I may dwell among them. And how close is that? God came to live in a tent in the Old Testament time, but it was still all these barriers around it. But God became flesh and dwelt there, born in Bethlehem, living in Nazareth, on the road with 12 disciples. Right there. What a gracious thing he's showing. The same sort of things that we mentioned before. We thought of the tent being magnificent on the inside and ordinary on the outside. Couldn't you say the same about Jesus? On the outside, he's just ordinary. There's nothing in him that would draw people to him. He just looks like every other Jewish man. He just looks like everyone else. Nothing particularly beautiful about him at all. But then sometimes we see glimpses of his magnificence, his power, his grace, the glorious things that he does. There's that magnificence veiled, isn't it? Which again is another word of using tented. His glory is tented, hidden by a tent of ordinariness. What grace for God to come in human flesh and live amongst us. And there, John says, sometimes at least we saw his glory. Maybe thinking especially of the transfiguration and the glory that was revealed there, which of course has an awful lot of similarities to Exodus chapter 40, which we'll get to one time in the end. There is this gracious thing that God does. Next little thing we wanted to make out, we were talking about the camp and the tabernacle being central in it. Well, we could think of the same. As we think of the tent that points us towards Christ and how central he is. There, the tabernacle was central in the camp. But here sometimes, even Christians, even well-meaning Christians, can go a little bit wrong. We think of the Old Testament tabernacle, which became then the Old Testament temple. The temple was going to be built on exactly the same format, roughly doubled in size. That's what they did then when Solomon in the end built the temple later on. Get the right word. And some people then move forward to the New Testament and think, well, we'll take all of those things and we'll apply it now to a New Testament church building. Especially the Roman Catholics did that. Your ginormous cathedrals are modelled in some ways on the tent of the tabernacle and the temple and things like that. That's what they're modelled on. Even in our country, the big Anglican cathedrals, kind of their structures are all like the tabernacle. But that's not where we're meant to be going. That's never said in the New Testament. Take those Old Testament ideas of architecture and then build a New Testament church in the same format. And think about buildings in that way. That's not at all where the thought was going. The point of this tent is not to point us towards a cathedral. The point of this tent is to point us to Christ. The Old Testament tabernacle, the temple it developed into, are there to show us Christ. And if we get involved too much in buildings and trying to make them a bit like this, then we've completely missed the point. Apologies, of course, because we're renting an Anglican church building. So there at the front, we do have a funny wooden box covered with funny cloths. And we do have a wooden rail round it. And there are certain similarities there to the tabernacle. But, of course, we're only renting the place. And as people who just are tenants, there's limited things you can do with a sledgehammer. But the point of it is to show us Christ, really. Not to worry about the architecture and stuff and furniture. They had furniture, we got Christ. We don't need furniture. What did Jesus say? John, again, John chapter 2, verse 19. Destroy this temple and I will build it again in 3 days. And what's Christ talking about? Not the need for buildings. He's talking about his own body. He said, I am the temple. The tabernacle, the temple are pointing us to Christ's body. And that's the centrality of those things. That's what it's important. So you can forget the sort of the architecture and the furniture and things like that. We don't need those things in church. The centrality of the cross is what it's all pointing to. Destroy this temple. Jesus is saying, you're not going to need it. You're not going to need the building he was pointing to with the disciples and those around him. You're not going to need this tent anymore. You don't need to try and build one. You don't need to make your churches look like it. You can get rid of all that because I will build it in 3 days. Because it's about me. Jesus is saying, forget the architecture. It's all pointing to me. I'm the one who is central. And so he is the center of the cross in history, the center of God's promises. Everything is fulfilled in what Christ does for us at the cross. All of those things that the tabernacle was just hinting at, Jesus would do in the reality. The centrality of that. And coming back to what we said before, a living relationship with Christ has to be central. It can't just be a fact. It can't just be an occasional Sunday you wander along to church and that's the bit of religion for you. It has to be central to you too. And one last thing then. It's got to be precise. How can we meet with God? That was the Old Testament question too. They wanted to know how the Israelites could meet with God. And the answer is only the way he says. And so in these chapters, you can follow it through. The number of times that is said. God said this, so the Israelites built this. God said this, so the Israelites built this. And that's how they do it. Because the only way they can meet with God is by doing exactly what he says. And doing it in the way he says. And then we thought just one thing about the tabernacle. That there's one gate on one side. And where's that pointing? Back to Christ again, isn't it? John chapter 10 and verse 7. I am the door for the sheep. No one can come in except through me. Or in John chapter 14 and verse 6. I am the way, the truth and the life. Those things in the tabernacle were pointing to Jesus. That there's one door, one way to meet with God. And that is through Christ. He's the way, the truth and the life. We thought of the Old Testament Israelites coming in through the door. And what do they see? They see an altar. And then they see a basin. And then they see the tent where God meets them. And those same things are a picture for us, aren't they? But it's through his sacrifice, through him washing us clean, that we approach a holy God. It's there in picture format, a kind of visual aid for what Christ would do. We come through Christ. We come and put our trust in him. We come and confess our sins to him. We trust in his sacrifice, because those ones of animals couldn't do anything. The real thing was Jesus. We trust in him. He's the one who washes us clean by his own blood. That's how we approach the living God. And so that's how we meet with God. And what a wonderful thing it is to have God with us. It's there in those verses that we often think about at Christmas. The wonder of the incarnation of God with us. Not much more time this morning to think about how that might go in the future. But of course that rolls on in, doesn't it, into the New Testament. We'll do more at another time. That now we as people, are a dwelling place for the Holy Spirit. And so in Ephesians, God's people are called a living temple. Because now God lives in us by his Holy Spirit. And one day, of course, to dwell with God forever. And heading on into Revelation 21, where you see those pictures of God's home and the New Jerusalem and things like that coming down from heaven. And a voice says, now the dwelling place of God is with men. And I will be their God and they will be my people and I will wipe away every tear from their eye. And you know the passage of where it's pointing to in the future too. And those things being fulfilled through Christ. That now we have his presence with us. And then one day to live with him in an even greater way. So when God went camping with the Israelites, it's just a little picture story in some ways. To point us forward to the realities of what Christ has done for us. And so in the days ahead, whether or not you're literally camping, we're going with Jesus with us. We meet with him here together as people, not a building, as people. Christ is here with us. He's then travelling with us in the days ahead. One day to live with him forever in glory. What a wonderful thing it is just to think back of these Old Testament pictures that show us Christ. Show us the wonder of what it is for God to be Emmanuel, God with us.